For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we've been studying through the book of Matthew, and last week we launched into this very famous, significant passage in Matthew chapter 5, known as the Sermon on the Mount. This is probably the most famous teaching of Jesus Christ in the Bible. And if you remember correctly, one of the main things that we saw in this Sermon on the Mount is that Jesus is teaching his followers how they are supposed to live. He was emphasizing that they're supposed to be different from this world around them. You know, he says, you are children of God. You have a special relationship to me. You know, the reason Jesus came to earth was to create a community of people who have been forgiven. And that community is called the church. And he's saying, these are the kind of people that I want to be in my kingdom, in the community that I'm going to create. And one of the main points of contrast here is he's showing them how they should be different, yes, from the world, but especially different from the dominant religious perspective of their day, something known as Pharisaism, advocated by the Pharisees. These were the religious leaders of the day, and they had developed this elaborate system of self-righteousness, of external works, of looking good on the outside, of doing their good deeds before other people to see, so other people can see them, and so they can get praise and admiration from people. They were very wealthy from this, and they just spent a lot of their time thinking about, I wish everybody could be as holy, as good, as righteous as I am. And what Jesus is saying is this is not the way that it is to be among you. He's advocating something very different, something that starts with an admission of our spiritual poverty. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit, fortunate, happy, content, joyful. Blessed by God are the poor in spirit. Those who are spiritually impoverished, they can admit how far short they fall of God's standard of perfection and how the only leg that they have to stand on is God's mercy and forgiveness. All they can do is, like the story that we read of the very sinful tax collector who was just beating his chest and saying, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Couldn't even look up at God. You know, this is the kind of attitude that Jesus wants his followers to have. Not the kind of people that are totally satisfied and pretty proud of their own righteousness, but those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, who want to be more like God. And ultimately, the kind of people in Jesus' kingdom, the kind of people in his community, these are people that show mercy to other people and also have received the mercy of God. And so he's showing them how we should live. And this, you have to understand that not just what he's preaching, but what he's preaching against. A lot of people misinterpret. They misunderstand the Sermon on the Mount because they ignore who he's preaching against, which is this self-righteous, Pharisaic mentality. And, you know, one of the things that what he's saying naturally leads to is how far short we fall. What he's doing is he's raising the bar back up to where it's supposed to be. Now, the Pharisees had lowered the bar to something that human beings could follow all of these rules and they could actually feel like they were good enough, they were righteous enough, they were perfect as far as God was concerned, and they could approach him and that God was pretty lucky to have people like them. And Jesus is saying, no, not at all. And this is why, for example, at the end of Matthew chapter 5, he says, if you want to, you know, really what you need to be is you need to be as perfect as God is perfect if you want to enter into the kingdom of heaven. And so he's setting a standard that is so ridiculous, that is so high, as we'll see next week and in the couple weeks after that, that there's no way that you can come out of this thing without feeling a certain sense of despair, without realizing your spiritual poverty, that spiritually you don't have a penny to your name, that you need a handout from God. And so he's showing how short we fall, and he's driving people to the mercy and the grace of God. And so last week we looked at the first six, what are called the first six Beatitudes, and those dealt more with the individual and a relationship to God. He started to get into how we relate to the world around us. But this week he turns and it's focused much more on how we relate to the world around us. And so we'll see in Matthew chapter 5, verse 9, let's just get into this. He says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. This is one of the totally unique things about Christians, is that we have peace with God because of what Jesus Christ has done. Not because we're really good and that we somehow negotiated peace with God, but because we've been forgiven, because Jesus Christ has lived a perfect life and died the death that we deserve to die. And so the alienation, the hostility between us and God has been taken out of the way. And so we have peace with God. And this peace that we have, this will work its way out into our lives in an internal peace, the peace that passes all understanding, Paul calls it, in the Philippians passage we studied a few months back. And also it translates into a peace that we have with one another. And so as Christians, we know how to resolve conflict. We know how to resolve conflict. So, you know, I know that I know how to apologize to someone when I'm alienated from them, when I'm in conflict with someone. Even if they're the ones that started it, even if they're more wrong than I was, even if they haven't apologized yet, we also know that I'm sorry you're so hypersensitive is not an actual apology. You know, we know that maybe there may be some times where we actually need to confront someone who's wrong. That in order to make peace, we might need to make a little bit of war. We might need to have to actually rock the boat a little bit in order to make peace in a certain relationship. You know, we know how to give someone the benefit of the doubt and how to listen to them instead of just coming in with both guns drawn and fully loaded, ready to just blast them with how we think the situation is. You know, we know that just sitting around complaining about the person doesn't do any good for us or for the other person, and it's wrong. It's sin in God's eyes. And so we know how to resolve conflicts that we have with another person. And in addition to that, we know how to help other people resolve their conflicts with one another. You know, we've learned to become the kind of people that are easy to please, that are not easily offended. We can overlook a lot of wrongs against ourselves so that we can help other people. And, you know, there's certainly some conflicts that we wouldn't want to get involved with. We know the difference between one we should wade into and one we shouldn't. We know, but when we do wade in, we know how to wade in sensitively in a way that actually helps the two people come to a resolution. Because, you know, we care about people too much to allow them to remain alienated from one another, whether it's a hostile, active, obvious disunity, or whether it's more of a cold, passive division between two people. And we know that peace faking and tolerance aren't good enough. That, yes, there is a difference between peacemaking and peace faking, as Ken Sandy calls it. But, you know, what he's talking about here, he's not saying blessed are the peaceful or blessed are those who just don't have any conflict around them. He's assuming that we're in a hostile world, a world where people just can't get along with each other. This is one of the main effects of our rebellion against God. When we said God no thank you, we wanted to head our own direction. When we broke our relationship with him, it broke our relationships with one another. And we've got everybody trying to be God in all of our relationships. And so, you know, the peace needs to be actively and consciously pursued. It's not something that's just going to happen. And, you know, just trying to cover everything up and pretend like nothing's wrong, that's not good enough. You know, some of us are more prone to that, and this might be why, you know, for example, we can't stand to be around our families. Because, you know, it's like we get around each other, and all of a sudden it's like this pressure begins to build inside of me. And you can feel it like across the whole room, and you're like, we better keep this real short, we better keep the TV on, or this thing is going to blow. All right, so we know that we know that's just not enough. And we know that, you know, the postmodern idea of tolerance, where I'm just going to, you know, stay away from you and not really care, and, you know, we're going to call that acceptance, we're going to call that peace, we know that's not good enough either. We know that God has called us to peace, active pursuit of peace. And we know that he has given us the ability, the resources to make peace. We can admit we're wrong, which goes a long way toward making peace in any situation. Helps you begin to see things clearly because we've been forgiven by God. And we know that, you know, as a result, they will be called sons of God. And what he means here by sons of God, you know, he means people that resemble God, people that are like God. It's like people can look and they can see there's something that's totally different about you. You know how to actually get along with people. These are the kind of followers that Christ wants to have. This is the kind of characteristics that he wants us to have. And, you know, I had an experience a couple years ago where I really saw this come into focus. All right. My wife at the time was working at, like, you know, your standard office job. It's like something straight out of The Office, except it's not as funny because it's your actual life and it's not a sitcom. And, you know, one day she came back from a break So her team had gotten this new supervisor, this new boss that everybody just hated. Okay, and this woman had a lot of problems. She was overseeing their group, but the rest of the analysts, they would just sit around and complain about her, and it really got to be pretty draining. And my wife felt pretty uncomfortable with that, and so she would just politely step out of those conversations and not really enter into those. You know, she's trying to love this woman, and at the same time, love her her coworkers. And so, one day she comes back from a break. She walks into her cube, and she sees one of her coworkers right there hovering over her computer. And immediately, the woman pops up looking startled and terrified and made some really lame excuse and hurried on out of her cube. And, there were certain things they would do where they would actually have to get on each other's computers, but her whole reaction seemed really, really strange. And so her email was up, and so she looked at her email. There's nothing fishy there. She looked in her trash bin. Nothing fishy there. But she decided to go ahead and check the super secret double deletion trash bin, which is where emails go when they get deleted out of your trash. And wouldn't you know it, right there, the very top email in that bin was an email from the coworker that had just been in her cube. And the coworker and the email said, I'm getting so sick of Chris, that's my wife's name. Her head is so far up our boss's butt that I can't even see it anymore. I don't know if she thinks she's going to get some kind of a promotion through this, but it's just making me nauseated. And so this is the email she's looking at, all right? Now, what would you do if you were in that situation? You know, some people would storm right over and chew the other person out. I think a lot of us, we would just be like, well, I guess that's the end of that relationship. And, my wife came home and she was telling me about all this. And that basically she had decided in her mind, I know I have to work with this woman, but I am just going to try to never, ever talk to her again. And so I told her, I was like, well, you realize you're going to have to go in and bring this up with her. And she said that, the feeling she got was just like she wanted to vomit. But, she went into work the next day and she said she would do it. And she went right over to the coworker's cube. And she chickened out. So she came home, she went back the next day, gave it another shot. And she said, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? And she said, woman said, yeah. And she goes, I saw the email. And the woman just got this look of horror on her face. And the first thing she blurted out was, I'm so sorry, I meant to send that to somebody else. Like that's going to make it better, Of course she meant to say this. Somebody was addressed to someone else. And she goes, do you mind if we go and talk? And so they went down, they found a place to talk, and she basically explained, if you've got a problem with me, the way I'm interacting with people, you should just come and talk to me. That is not my motives. The reason why, I'm not trying to kiss my boss's butt here. I'm just trying to be nice to her. I feel kind of bad for her. And, ultimately I'm a Christian. You know that. And God has forgiven me, and he calls on me to love people, even people who are my enemies, even people I don't like as that well. And that's what I'm trying to do here. And she also said, I forgive you for what you did, and I want us to still have a relationship. And, the impact that this had on her relationship with that woman, it was like, not only was the relationship restored, but they were so much closer after that. This woman obviously felt so loved. And, as a woman who really didn't have peace in any other area of her life, she realized that there's something different about this woman. There's something different about this Christian who knows how to make peace. And it's such a sweet thing for people that never taste peace in their lives. And so, it's I think, a real great example of this passage here that they will be called sons of God. People will know that we're different. They'll know that we're different if we are willing to become peacemakers with the resources that God has given to us. And so Christ is calling us to be peacemakers, active, intentional peacemakers. And he goes on. He says, unfortunately, not every relationship can end in peace, though. And he says, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And so, try as we might, there may be relationships where we just can't make peace. The other person is unwilling to make peace. And in fact, we may experience even greater conflict, even hostility, even attacks from other people. Not because of wickedness, not because we're mean or nasty, but it says because of righteousness. Because we're actually doing the right thing. We may get flack from other people. He goes on, he repeats this one. He says, blessed are you, not just blessed are those, but blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. And so this is pretty surprising to a lot of people that following Christ will actually cause more conflict in some of their relationships. Yes, Jesus came to bring peace, but he also says things like this. Don't imagine that I came to bring peace to the earth. I came not to bring peace, but a sword. I've come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Your enemies will be right in your own household. The people you're closest to, your family members, may turn on you, may turn against you because of Christ. And he says that's a sacrifice you're going to have to be willing to make if you're going to be his disciple. He says, if you love your father or mother more than you love me, you're not worthy of being mine. If you love your son or daughter more than me, you are not worthy of being mine. You know, if that other person calls on you to make a choice here, you know, Christ has to be your top priority. You have got to pick Christ. When two people come into conflict, if somebody's like, do you love Jesus or me more? The answer always has to be Christ, no matter who the person is. That's what he's calling for here. And, you know, people are real surprised. You'll see, like, new Christians go home and try and tell their family members or their best friends about the most incredible thing that's ever happened to them. And they're so happy now, and they're so joyful, and it's like they've come alive, and life finally is worth living. And they get indifference, or they get anger from the other people. And it's like they're so confused as to what's going on here. You know, part of this is because the message of the gospel, the message of the Bible, is offensive. You know, there's the bad news, which is you're not good enough. You'll never be good enough for God. Everything you've done, all of your good deeds, they can't outweigh the bad things that you've done. And honestly, in God's sight, even one single wrong deed, you do anything wrong your whole life, that's enough to send you to hell for eternity, separated from Him. The bar is that high. But Jesus Christ loves you. And Jesus died. Jesus took the punishment that you deserve. If you admit you need it, if you admit your guilt and ask for that forgiveness, you're forgiven. You're adopted as his child. But you see, some people get so upset at the first part, the bad news, that they cannot admit that they need forgiveness. They cannot embrace the good news because they're so mad that they're being told they're wrong. I was doing a wedding last week. And I kept trying to figure out how I can make this wedding message in such a way that I take out that part that says, you're a sinner in need of forgiveness. And I finally realized I can't pull that part out without changing the whole message of that Christ and God, are trying to communicate here. You know, you can't pull that part. You can't pull the bad news out and just have the goodness. You got to have both. And, you know, and so it's going to be offensive to some people. And, you know, in some cases, part of what the problem, too, is what you're saying is I found the right way. I found the narrow path, as Christ calls it, the path that leads to salvation and few who find it. But, you know, by implication, what you're saying is I wasn't on the path before, the path that you're still on, and I want you to come with me. All right? So there's an implicit critique of the path the other person is on just by telling them what you found. And most people want their loved ones to join them in this direction that they're taking here. But, you know, Christ is saying there's going to be times when you're going to catch a lot of flack for this. I just want to warn you now. That's why he's saying this not just once, but twice. And then he's repeating it again in kind of another form here. He says, blessed are those and blessed are you. He knew the disciples were going to go to their death for the sake of him. He knew that he was going to go to his death for the sake of righteousness. And if you find yourself in this situation, he does offer a few points of encouragement here. First of all, he says, you know, ultimately this is because of me. Ultimately, this is not about you and them. This is about me and them. And his disciples really understood this in the book of Acts. They got beaten severely, painfully. And it says they went on their way from the presence of the council rejoicing that they had been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name. They felt so grateful that they had been considered worthy of suffering just like, well, not just like Christ, but, you know, suffering in the name of Christ. Because they realized that the conflict that they had with the religious leaders, the council, this was really just the conflict that Jesus had with them. All right, they killed him, and now it had just transferred onto them. And they knew that this was just the overflow from that. This was not about them. This was a problem between them and God. And they were just being faithful as messengers to declare what was true. And you've got to realize this if you find yourself in this position. You know, I mean, there are times where Christians are really offensive and where they actually do bring, you know, offense because of the way they're acting needlessly. But a lot of the time, it's because you're just telling people what Jesus was telling people, and they're getting really angry. And you've got to understand, it's not about you. This is a problem between them and God. And if you're here tonight and you've been, like, really annoyed by Christians, again, it may be because they were just annoying, but it may be not about you and them, but it may be because you know that you've got a problem with God and they're telling you that thing that you don't want to hear. They're telling you that you need forgiveness. Just like they're admitting they need forgiveness, they're saying everybody needs forgiveness. This is not a self-righteousness thing. This is everybody needs righteousness and nobody's good enough. And so he says, you got to remember this is because of me why this is going to happen to you. And that, quite frankly, no student is greater than his teacher. No servant is greater than his master. He says, if they persecuted me, they're also going to persecute you. He also says, great is your reward in heaven. I think this one's pretty encouraging as well, that Christ sees the suffering that we're going through, and that doesn't go unnoticed. That he actually is going to reward us, not just in this life, but also in the life to come, for the suffering that we've undergone for his name. It's not in vain. He sees it, and we will be rewarded for that. He urges us to continue to overcome, continue to persevere. And ultimately, he says, in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. This is a mark of authenticity. This is exactly what they were going to do to Jesus. This is exactly what they were going to do to his disciples. And there's really maybe no other point here in the Beatitudes that more exposes how wrong the Pharisees are than this one right here. Because the Pharisees, you know, the life that they were living was a life where they got all this glory, they were wealthy, they got all of this recognition, they looked really good, they were not uncomfortable, they had really whatever their heart desired. They appeared like they had it together on the outside. You know, and Christ is saying, when in the history of the people of God has this ever been the normal Christian life? Since when is following God about, you know, this being this really easy road with no problems, no bumps? Following God is about suffering. Following God is about shedding our blood. Following God is about following in the footsteps of Jesus Christ, about picking up our cross and following him. No matter what the cost might be. And I think a lot of times, you know, we feel like there's something wrong here because I'm suffering. There's something wrong because I'm catching flack from other people. And if we're honest with ourselves, I think we've got to admit that our perception of spirituality is much more Pharisaic than Christian. You know, we want the kind where we're comfortable and recognized and wealthy and we feel like we've got it all together. And Christ says, no, not at all. Blessed are you when you're persecuted for the sake of my name, when you're persecuted for the sake of righteousness. Love this quote from Watchman Nee. He says, to keep our hand on the plow while wiping away our tears. That is Christianity. And you know, that's not going to sell a lot of books. It's not going to fill a lot of baseball stadiums, but it's the truth. This is what the Bible declares about the Christian life. And if we're upset that this is the way that it is, then you need to take that up with God. And you can, at the very least, you can be comforted in the fact that Jesus Christ went through far more than you'll ever go through, and he's God. Okay, he didn't deserve any of it. He left the comforts of heaven to come down to suffer and die for you. And now he's calling on you to taste a little bit of his sufferings. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. And he says, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And it's just like the first beatitude. He says, you know, if you want the kingdom of heaven, this is not like your payment to get in, but this is one of the costs of it. You know, if we're going to own a car, we know that there's certain costs involved in that, but we know that, you know, owning a car is a good thing. And so it's worth whatever costs might go along with it. It's the same way with the kingdom of heaven. There's certain costs. Paul says, all who want to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. There's no way of avoiding that. So I think we should be more worried when we're not catching any flack, when we're not suffering any persecution, than when we are. Well, he goes on to talk more about the way that we interact with the world around us. And in doing so, he uses two metaphors. First one, in verse 13, he says, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. So the first metaphor he uses is salt. Salt back then, you know, the days before electricity, the days before refrigeration, was primarily used as a preservative. You know, today it's more for flavor. And back then, the flavor was kind of a nice side effect of the preservation. But, you know, if you've got, you know, some kind of food product, some kind of meat product, on its own, it's going bad within a few days. But, you know, you get some salt, you rub that salt in there, and then you might get a couple of months or even more out of that. And he says if the one danger is that the salt might lose its saltiness, and that would be a really bad thing. Now, salt actually can't lose its saltiness. It's a pretty stable chemical compound. You know, the way they got their salt is they would basically go down, like, down to the Dead Sea, for example, or down to, like, a salt marsh, and they would just kind of grab some big white rocks that were big salty rocks, or maybe, like, a handful of, like, this white gravel that was just, there was a lot of salt in there, but there was some other things, too. And they would just kind of take maybe two rocks and just kind of put it around their fish and wrap it up, and that was how they would preserve it. Or they'd rub some of this gravelly, salty stuff in there. Well, the problem is the salt is real soluble in water, and so if some water gets in there, then the salt will be absorbed into the water, and the water can essentially carry the salt away. So all you're left with is just kind of like a big white rock, or this, like, you know, white dust, essentially, that doesn't have any preservative value. And so, you know, you can rub that stuff all day long into whatever food you've got, and that's not going to do any good for preservation. All right, so you might have a case where something kind of looks like salt, and yet it's lost its saltiness. It's worthless. And the only thing it's good for is just to be thrown out on the ground where people are walking around. And so he's saying the Christian should be the salt of the earth. So in this metaphor, the earth is kind of like the food product, and we are the salt, and, you know, we should be right in there, in the earth, in the world, rubbing shoulders with people, and that we have some sort of a positive, preservative effect on the society around us. It's like society is this big piece of meat that is just, like, going bad, and the Christians are the thing that keeps it from going bad. He uses another metaphor that's real similar. We'll read this before thinking about the implications. He says, you're the light of the world, a city on a hill. So salt of the earth and then light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Okay, so again, in the days before electricity, dark is really dark. Okay, we don't, especially living in the city, we never see really real darkness like that unless you're, like, in the bathroom in an inner room of your house or something. You know, that's dark. All right, where you can't even see your hand in front of your face. And so, you know, in this level of darkness, if you've ever been camping, for example, out in the middle of nowhere, you know that a little bit of light can go a long way in pitch black darkness. And whether that's a lamp right there on a stand in the middle of this, the little one-bedroom houses that they have, which could even a dim lamp could light the whole room, and certainly well enough for people to do what they need to do. Or you might have a city up on a hill where just the combined total of the different lights from the different houses could shine out into the pitch black night for miles and miles. And he's saying, you know, either way, light is real important. And you wouldn't want to light your lamp only just to immediately put it out again. That would be foolish. You've got to light that thing and you've got to let it shine before men. And so he says, in the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. So as Christians, it's like we're these lights shining out into the darkness in this world. And he says, don't hide it. Don't put it out. Shine that thing out into the darkness. All right, so let's talk just about two implications of this as we wrap, before we wrap up here. First of all, the point of the salt and the light, he says, we're called to be different because we are different. He says, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. You're different. If you belong to Christ, if you've been forgiven by him, if you've been cleansed and transformed by him, you're different. You're not like everyone else. And so he's not saying you should be something you're not. He's saying you got to be what you are. You got to be the person that God has made you to be. And what that means is right in there among the world, among the people of this world, rubbing shoulders with the people of this world and yet shining, preserving, you know, flavoring the world, the people around you in a really positive way. It's a really cool vision for the impact that God wants us to have on this society, and it all comes back to who we are, who he's made us to be. And so we're called to be different because we are different. And secondly, there's a real responsibility that comes across here. We carry a certain responsibility as representatives of Jesus. You know, if you're the one with the torch, if you're the one with the light, the people in the darkness, they're counting on you. You know, if you've got the only salt, then the people that people that have the food, they need you to keep the food from rotting, to keep things, and also positively. So there's kind of a negative and a positive. The salt keeps things from going bad, and the light is more of a positive, proactive shining here. And so, you know, this is not a lot of Christians. They see this, and they're different in the wrong way. And maybe some of us know Christians like this. Maybe some of us have been Christians like this. Maybe some of us are Christians like this. Different in the wrong way. All right? Some Christians see this and they just withdraw. You know, they feel like the holiest thing I can do is just to go out and find a monastery somewhere, to find a hill to meditate on. And that is God's will for my life. You know, the problem is I'm interacting in this society and all these people are making me sin. There's all these temptations everywhere. I'm getting angry, I'm lusting, I'm coveting, I'm lying, I'm stealing, I'm taking. I just got to get out of here. And so there's a withdrawal, there's a retreat from the evil, wicked world around us. And this has been very common, very popular. Even in the day of Christ, this was real popular. There was a huge community living out by the Dead Sea that just felt like society sucks, we got to get out of here. And he's saying, no. You know, I didn't give you this light so you could go hide it. I didn't give you this salt so you could just kind of go out wherever. I want you to be right there with the people. I want you to be in society. You got to be shining before this world. And so we're not withdrawing. We're also not into weirdness. You know, some people feel like they want to be different, and so they end up being different in these really, really weird ways. It's like Christians, it's like we create our own subculture with our own music and our own movies and our own, you know, entertainment forms and those sorts of things. And it's like we've withdrawn from this world. I've got an example of this. It's a little article I found called Should Christian People Play Cards? By J.D. Carlson. Perhaps you've heard of him. I hadn't. And He had some pretty illuminating facts about playing cards that I wanted to share with you guys. He says, for millions of people, the card game is a strong and strange fascination. Wherever you go, you see people playing cards. On my missionary journey as I fly, I often see people playing cards by the hour. And people ask me, what really is the difference between playing a game of checkers and a game of cards? Well, there's an ocean of difference between the two games, and I will endeavor to show you why. Checkers are fine, okay? Cards are the problem. He says the church in days gone by took a stand against the card game. Ministers preached against it, and big bonfires were built as people burned their playing cards. Dr. Talmadge, a great minister has ever served the Presbyterian denomination, said he would rather have his children play with a nest of rattlesnakes than with a deck of cards. Of course, this was years ago. Today and for many years, the church and its pulpit have been silent in speaking against card playing. This is interesting. The first deck of cards was invented by King Charles of France in the year 1392. King Charles was an insane man, by the way. Now, perhaps you've never heard this, so notice carefully what I'm going to say. A deck of cards used to be called the Devil's Bible. And in the 17th century, it was called the Devil's Picture Book. This is very important for us to know. Each card in the deck has a special meaning. Men who know tell me this is true. The cards have a secret language. Here's what I mean. The king card represents the prince of darkness, the devil. The 10 spots, whatever that is, speaks of the spirit of lawlessness. It speaks in opposition to the moral laws found in the 10 commandments of the Bible. And the club card represents violence and murder. The jack speaks of the loose living man, the lustful man, the licentious individual who lives only to satisfy his lower nature. The queen card represents Mary, the mother of our Lord. In the language of the cards, however, Mary is represented as an impure, dissolute, immoral woman. There's the joker. It represents Jesus Christ. But also, the climax of all that is diabolical in connection with the language of the cards is this. Jesus Christ, the Joker, is said to be the child, the offspring of the licentious Jack and the Queen. I wish I didn't have to tell this. It is so vile, so dreadful in its implication that every man and woman who loves and adores the Savior who died to redeem us with his own blood must cry out in protest against such blasphemy. And after what's been said about the Jack, the Queen, and the Joker, there's no need of further exposure of the card language. But let me ask you a question. Why don't people, when they play cards, first ask God to bless their card game? Can you do that? Of course you cannot. And remember that 9/10 of all gambling is done with cards. And also remember that 9/10 of those who gambled today learned how to play cards at home. And 9/10 of all statistics are made up right there on the spot. No Christian should play cards. Surely no Sunday school teacher should play cards. The Bible said, touch not the unclean thing. And as far as I'm concerned, I would not allow the dirty deck to desecrate my Christian home and tarnish my testimony. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about right there. Just complete anti-cultural weirdness, taking stands on the wrong things. And just basically the point is, you can either be normal and involved in culture, or you can be a Christian weirdo. All right. This is the message a lot of Christians communicate, and this is a message that a lot of non-Christians get from the Christian world. So we're not withdrawing from society. We're not turning into weirdos. Hopefully we're not like a nuisance or an irritation as well in the circles in which we run. I mean, think about your neighbors, okay? If you're like where you live, let's say you live with a bunch of other believers, If you guys just like one day told all the neighbors, hey, we're moving out, sorry, nice quiet family's moving in here, would they be like really sad that you're leaving or really happy that you're leaving? You know, the witness, the impact that we have in our neighborhoods is significant. And the fact that, you know, the college group especially is getting so huge, you know, we're becoming more and more of a public presence here on campus. And we need to really be careful to safeguard not our reputation, ultimately the reputation of Christ. Because people are going to look at the people they know from our fellowship, and they're going to draw conclusions not just about this church, but about Jesus Christ as well. Think about your work. I mean, are you like the hardest worker there? Are you the star employee? Or are you the one that is, you know, if you quit tomorrow, your boss would be kind of relieved? You know, I'm not saying that we sell out, that we become like the world where we, you know, some people feel like in order to be a good witness at work, that means I just need to do whatever they ask me to do. I'm setting up no boundaries at my job. I'm just living like everybody else. And that's not what he's talking about at all. He says, you know, the salt can't lose its saltiness. We can't just blend in with the values of the culture around us. Okay, so we're different. We're the best employee, and yet we make it clear, my life is not my job. And I remember getting chewed out by my boss in front of a couple other employees for this very thing right here, for setting up boundaries. It was really painful, really embarrassing. I just felt like I wanted to crawl up into a hole, but you know, it was the right thing. It was what I needed to do. And so, what kind of witness are we showing? Are we living as salt? Are we living as light? Are people seeing us? Are they seeing what we do? And are they glorifying our Father who is in heaven? You know, what he's talking about here, he's talking about different in a good way. This is ultimately what Jesus is calling his people to be. As we interact in this world, as we really get into people's lives, what they should see is a real difference, a good difference. You know, the kind of difference where we're able to actually build healthy relationships, where we have successful relationships, eventually successful marriages, eventually successful families. Nobody can do that. Try as they might, no matter how much money they spend on technology, no matter how much money they spend on vacation, no matter how much money they spend indulging whatever they want to do, people can't build healthy relationships. Christ says, they'll know you're my disciples by your love for one another. And so our relationships should shine. And I know for a lot of us here, that's exactly what's happening. People are looking at you and they're glorifying Christ. They're praising Christ because they realize there's something different about this person. There's something really good that's different about this person, and I like it. And I wouldn't mind if my life looked like that person's life. That's ultimately what he's talking about here. They see your life, and there's just something so attractive about it. They're drawn to it, that they want to follow Jesus because of the way that you live and the way that you've interacted with them, the way you've loved them. You know, they see your joy. They see your contentment. They see that even when really bad circumstances come your way, you seem to have a buoyancy. Well, you don't get taken down by that. You've got a hope even when in circumstances that would seem as dark as night to anyone else. And yet there you are with a good attitude. There's an other-centeredness about you. There's a reality to you where people know there's something different about this girl. There's something different about this guy. The world needs us. The world needs people that are living out the teaching of Christ. The world needs people that know how to make peace. The world needs people who are committed to doing the right thing, committed to Christ, no matter what the cost might be in their lives. The world needs people who are following, who are like the kind of person that Jesus has been describing here so far in the Beatitudes. People who are humble, people who are gentle, people who are eager to become more like Christ, people who are merciful, people who are hungry for righteousness. These are the kind of people that God has called us to be. And he's called us to bring the message of truth, both with our words and with our actions to this world around us. And so that's what Jesus is calling for here. Yeah, Lord, we're privileged to serve and to be known by such a good and loving God. Thank you that you didn't lower the bar and sweep justice under the rug, but you took the demands of justice upon yourself, and you suffered in our place, Lord, so that you could give us every spiritual blessing in the heavenly realms and quite a few here on earth as well. I do thank you that suffering with you is a joy and a privilege. And I thank you that, you know, when we get to heaven, no matter what our perspective is on our suffering in this life, that we'll be able to look back on it and say that it was all worth it as we spend eternity with you. I pray that if there's anyone that has not come to know you, that has not been transformed into the kind of, into a forgiven person, the kind of person that can become like what Jesus is talking about here in this passage, I pray they would really seriously consider that tonight, that they would turn to the only God, the God that loves them, the God who died for them, and that they would enter into true joy and happiness and the blessedness that Jesus Christ is talking about here. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.